Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As area college basketball teams prepare for March Madness, today we hear a story of a championship Oklahoma basketball team from a different era. In women's basketball, UConn's current unbeaten streak of 104 straight games is amazing the world. But did you know that from March 1931 to March 1934, the women of a small, long-forgotten college, Oklahoma Presbyterian College down in Durant, won 89 consecutive games, as well as two AAU championships, beating a Dallas AAU team led by the legendary female athlete Babe Dietrichson. Well, this is in an era before Title IX and before NCAA women's athletics, and the OPC Cardinals were among the first college female athletes to receive scholarships to attend school and play sports. In fact, the American Sports Establishment were against women's basketball, labeling it as both unhealthy and unladylike. Despite that, led by their coach Sam Babb, the team would more often than not play club teams with older players, akin to the Phillips 66ers in Bartlesville. Players were hired to work for a company, but as much to play sports in an era before big money professional sports. Lydia Reeder is the grandniece of Coach Sam Babb. She's a writer and journalist and has written about this team of small-town Oklahoma women who were pioneers in their sport and for their gender. Her book is titled Dust Bowl Girls, the inspiring story of the team that barnstormed its way to basketball glory. It's published by Algonquin Books. She'll be appearing in Tulsa tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Edison High School in an event hosted by Magic City Books. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Lydia Reeder, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
This book, Dust Bowl Girls, reminds us how different women's athletics were in the first half of the 20th century. And this particular story about the Oklahoma Presbyterian College women's team just sounds like something that you would not expect in college athletics, because in many ways this team was like a barnstorming team.
They were, and it was very rare for a women's college team back then to be competitive in what was referred to as the Industrial League. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was managed by the Amateur Athletic Union. They oversaw all men's and women's competitive amateur sports, and so most of the teams were from an industry, like the Dr. Pepper Girls or the or the Dallas Golden Cyclones, who played for an insurance company. They used them sort of as the public relations arm.
Well, in men's athletics, the Phillips 66ers, based out of Bartlesville, were a major power in AAU basketball, swimming, and a variety of sports for many years. And they were people who, again, who worked at the job, but mainly their occupation was playing sports.
Yes, and because it was amateur, they were listed as employees of the company. But they did, like Babe Dietrichson, was an employee of the insurance company that oversaw the Dallas Golden Cyclones, where she played. So, yes, they were employees, but people often questioned whether that was true or not.
And in the case of the Oklahoma Presbyterian College in Durant, Oklahoma, they fought toe-to-toe with some of these big AAU clubs and actually won the national championship in 1931?
32 and 33.
So how did you come up on this story?
Actually, the coach of the Cardinals was Sam Babb, and he was my great uncle. I never knew him, but he was my grandmother's favorite brother. So, and he died quite young, and most of his achievements were lost. So in the late 1970s, my grandmother campaigned to have him inducted into the Oklahoma Sports Hall of Fame, and he was inducted in 1979. But in order to get him inducted, she had to provide them with proof that he was a good coach. So she collected all kinds of information, including, you know, newspaper articles and photographs and letters from his players and things like that. And afterwards, she filed it away. Then years later, she handed over the folder to me because she thought I might want to tell their story. And sure enough, it was an amazing story.
So how did you end up in Durant with the Oklahoma Presbyterian College?
I actually went to Durant and ended up meeting Virginia Hamilton Childers. And by the time I got there, the Durant Presbyterian College had closed probably in the 1960s. But the buildings are still there, and it currently houses, it's the headquarters for the Choctaw Nation. But I ended up meeting one of the players, and she was basically the team historian, and she had layers of scrapbooks that she was happy to share, but she also provided contact information for the other living players and then the other players' family members. So I ended up contacting most of the players that were on the team then or their family members.
And what was really amazing about, you know, we think about the University of Connecticut women's team today, but this team between March 31 and March 34 won 89 consecutive games, including those two consecutive AAAU basketball championships.
They did, and they actually beat a team called the Edmonton Canadian Grads in 1933 up in Edmonton, which was almost unheard of. They beat them the best 3 out of 5, and so they took the name as North American champions. So they were going gangbusters, and it was kind of a barnstorming, meaning that they were self-sufficient team, self-financing, and took half the ticket receipts for every game that they played. So it was a different type of atmosphere back then.
Your great uncle, Sam Babb, how did he end up in Durant with this team? He wasn't a star athlete. In fact, he had lost a leg in an accident with his father on the farm as a young man.
Yeah, he had to wear a wooden prosthetic, but he ended up becoming a teacher and then a school superintendent in towns across Oklahoma. He grew up around Buffalo, Missouri, but came to Oklahoma and really established himself as an educator. And it was during a time when he was school superintendent for a small town in Oklahoma where he ended up having to coach both the boys and girls basketball team because the basketball coach left town suddenly. And that's where he really started to understand strategy and take an interest in coaching basketball. And it kind of went back and forth until about, I think it was 1929, he ended up at Oklahoma Presbyterian College, where he also taught psychology.
Now, you open the book with the star athlete being recruited by him. Uh-huh. She grew up in a little town called Cement, and basically this is what he would do. He would go around to all these little small towns and recruit and find these really fine high school basketball players and offer them a scholarship. From nearly all of them, they were the first person to even consider going to college from their family, and take them to play basketball.
And it was the Great Depression back then, too, so most people didn't have enough to eat. But they did, their little towns did play basketball, and that was what they did on Friday nights. They'd go and watch the girls and boys high school basketball teams play. So right around that time, women were really starting to play in the rural areas, especially in the Midwest and the South. And so star players were coming up, and Sam recruited the girls who made good grades because they were going to college and also were really good at basketball.
So what was special about this particular little small school? Was women's basketball be playing like on an NCAA level at that particular time?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, most of the country, the cultural norm was to discourage women playing competitive sports altogether. So for basketball to be popular at Oklahoma Presbyterian College, it was Sam, but it was also the college president. He was Reverend Hodgkin, and he loved basketball. And Presbyterian College had a basketball team before Sam came. They made it a point. It also housed a grade school and a high school for Native American kids. And probably more than half the players for the Cardinals were, you know, Choctaw, Chickasha, Seminole, from some Native American tribe. And that was where OPC was coming from when they sponsored basketball teams.
And as you mentioned, they were self-supporting. This was during the Depression. The school was at risk of closing, but this team would play tons of, they basically from the time the end of the semester through the beginning of the next semester, they were playing every day on the road, basically.
They played on the road during over the Christmas break for those 2 weeks. I think they barnstormed 15 games in Texas and Louisiana and Arkansas. And that was to make some money, but also to establish the team and to see how good they were. And that year, the Cardinals won every game, which really got noticed by the better teams. But then they did start playing regular season basketball, you know, starting in January. And so they would play home games and away games pretty normally, just like they kind of do now. But it was a lot easier to schedule a game in between if they wanted to.
But the interesting thing was is they were not playing other colleges. They were playing these,
right,
oftentimes, these amateur teams, which were almost semi-professional in a way. If you would.
Right.
And they were strictly a college team. They were expected to go to class and do all,
yes,
that.
They went to class. They had other extracurricular activities. Most of them had part-time jobs. They were really busy. So it was an amazing achievement what happened with this team. And Lucille Thurman, one of the best players who's featured in the book, wrote a 6 or 8 page letter to my grandmother about Sam Babb. And she said one of the most unique things about him was that he was able to recruit this group of girls that came together at that specific time. And then he managed to take their talents and put them where they would be most useful on the team. And it all kind of synergistically worked together to create this unexpectedly winning team. They were very young. The other industrial teams were quite older and had played together for years.
Now, you not only tell the story of this team and how they came together and Sam Babb's way of coaching, but you also explain so much about how different women's basketball was then and how it was perceived. Women's basketball had at least in certain quarters, a horrible reputation as being unladylike, and it was this sort of weird Victorian sentiment against this as it being unladylike to play women's basketball, which is kind of shocking today.
It is kind of shocking today, and actually it was shocking for those girls who had back then who had grown up on farms and worked in the fields and had done lots of physical labor just alongside their brothers, or, you know, milk the cows or did whatever chores they needed for their families to survive. So somebody telling them that they can't play basketball was like telling them they couldn't, you know, breathe. it just seems strange. But the cultural norms back then, especially at universities in women's physical education departments, was that extreme athletics or highly competitive athletics for women would debilitate them physically and emotionally incapacitate them. They didn't think that women could handle the rigors of highly competitive athletics. They wanted just regular exercise where they went out and maybe threw the ball around a little bit and got rosy-cheeked and things like that. But to see a woman being an expert at a certain type of sport was really only gaining momentum in the 1930s. It was an unusual thing, and I think created a lot of fear in these women who oversaw the cultural norms back then. It was just a little frightening to see these changes happening so quickly.
And this wasn't just a group of society ladies. The main organization that was against women's basketball and competitive sports was led by the First Lady of the United States, Lou Henry Hoover.
Lou Henry Hoover. There was an organization called the National Amateur Athletic Federation, and it was part of the federal government and overseen by the federal government. While she created the women's division of that National Amateur Athletic Federation, and she started it really because people were, for lack of a better word, freaking out at women developing such expertise in these sports. So they believed in what they called a sport for every girl and every girl for a sport, which is, you know, a wonderful idea if you want to create a country with women who are in good condition. But they were unfortunately against specialization and competition. So the young women who loved competitive sports, like those Zest Bowl girls, really battled every day against those traditional expectations of being a lady. So sometimes it was just epic for women to be able to play a sport back then.
My guest today is Lydia Reeder, a writer and journalist who is the author of Dust Bowl Girls, the inspiring story of the team that barnstormed its way to basketball glory. It's published by Algonquin Books. She'll be speaking about this team, which comes from Durant, Oklahoma, the national champions in 1932 and 1933, national AAU basketball championships. She'll be speaking about it tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Edison High School, an event hosted by Magic City Books. And she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, these women were really amazing and working in conditions that might be surprising to today's athletics of how hard they worked, how hard they trained. There were some amazing athletes. These women were competing against Babe Didrikson, probably known as one of the best female athletes of all time, who was a member of a Dallas team. And they actually came out on top against this team three times.
And they were the underdogs every single time. Nobody expected, they called them the little church school girls in the newspapers. They did not expect them to ever win, ever. It was always a mistake when they came out on top until, you know, they get to the national championship. And they, because they didn't have enough money, they could only take eight players to Shreveport, where the national championship was held. So they had a very shallow substitution range when they went into the finals. It was scary. If any of them had gotten injured, they might not have been able to finish the game. So it was always a precarious situation when they were playing.
And, of course, basketball, women's basketball, for those with older memories, because Oklahoma is one of the last states to play this older style of six-on-six, three forwards and three guards, and basically, you either played offense or defense. That was the women's basketball that they were playing, although even the rules were even more restrictive back then, weren't they?
Actually, for the AAU, they were pretty, they tried to make them as liberal as possible so that they would have a more exciting game. So the AAU would hash it out every summer with the Rules Committee for Women's Basketball from the women's division and try to come up with you know, a more exciting game. And actually, Sam Babb was on the Rules Committee and was part of the committee that, I think it was in 1933 or 32, I can't remember. But anyway, they liberalized the rules so that they could have a roving guard that ran the full court. So that actually helped speed up the game a little bit. But it was always low scoring because they had an extra guard on the court.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that they're really making up the rules each year.
They were modifying them every year. And, you know, some places still played what was called three-court basketball, where the court was divided into three sections. So it was kind of a strange set of rules that they had back then. But the AAU was basically half-court basketball, six-on-six.
Yeah, and you could only dribble the ball once.
And they said it had to be below the knee.
How interesting. So did you get to meet some of these players? Because these players went on a winning streak for about 3 years.
Yes.
And what were they like? What were their memories of this?
They all had vivid memories. This was probably, well, it changed the trajectory of their lives forever. It was a momentous occurrence in their lives. And afterwards, they all kept scrapbooks. They all, Lucille Thurman had even... She went on to become one of the greatest women basketball players of the 1930s, and she had started a manuscript for her life playing basketball. And it was wonderful to read that. And then Lara and Vera Dunford, who were the tall, redheaded twins. They actually had kept an old uniform, one of those satin uniforms that they used to wear, and they brought it out for us to see. So it was still... The memories of playing back then for the Cardinals were still vivid on these, you know, and they were in their mid-80s. They had never forgotten their times as the Cardinals.
Now, nearly all these women were first generation to go to college. How did that affect them? Did they end up being professional women, or were they becoming? Did they become coaches? What were their stories afterwards? Because you don't really tell that in the book.
Briefly, I say at the very end. And mm-hmm. Dahl Harris, who is
she was the star. She was the star. Forward and scored most of the points.
Yeah, and everyone thought she would go on to play basketball, but she injured her knee and. In 1933 and never really recovered from it. And she continued to play basketball for a while, but she started teaching school near Houston and was kind of a celebrity when she went down there to start teaching. And she was a teacher. She started out as a teacher and a coach. And I think she taught English along with coaching basketball. But then in the 1950s, maybe toward the 1950s, they eliminated basketball for a while. So she started coaching the women's dance team and took them to win the national championship. So she was quite a competitor, and after she retired, they named an athletic field after her. She was very popular.
I know others went to join a professional women's basketball team. It's hard to believe they had professional women's basketball teams in the 30s and 40s.
They had the All-American Redheads, and Lara and Vera, who were they always called them the six-foot-tall redheaded Dunford twins. They, along with Hazel Vickers, another player, were on the first iteration of what would become the All-American Redheads. They didn't call them the Redheads, but then at one point, and this was after the Cardinals had disbanded, at one point all the girls decided to dye their hair red like Lara and Vera, and afterwards they became known as the All-American Redheads, and they were kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters. They would give exhibition games, and they continued playing for many, many, many years. Now, Lara and Vera didn't, but the Redheads continued on and became quite a basketball dynasty in and of itself.
Well, what was the most interesting thing you learned as you began learning about this team, your own family, because you have an own family connection, but what was most interesting to you?
It was very interesting, first of all, to read about women's sports history and the basketball history. I found it completely fascinating. Women loved basketball when it first started. In fact, more women started playing it than men, probably because it started in Canada and it was indoors, and they could play it anytime they wanted. And then the development of the rules and the political storm that caused. But then also the fact that playing basketball for these young women and for Sam was very serious business. It wasn't just for fun. It wasn't second thought, you know, oh, let's do this just as an extracurricular activity. No, it was very serious business, and he treated it like it was a job, and he told them to play and practice like it was their job every day. And so that I found, because of the dire times and circumstances where in which they lived, that's how they had to do it. And he, you know, at one point told them that they had to be invincible. Well, in order to get funding, especially from the businesses around town, they had to make the games a good game. And that's what they did. And I just found that incredibly uplifting.
Now, they were a very serious team when they went out barnstorming. You know, this was also the time when you started seeing, like, professional baseballers in the off season doing barnstorming. The Harlem Globetrotters started about this same time, mm-hmm. Maybe a couple of years later. They started out playing serious basketball, but added the clowning in. But for them, for the school team, the Presbyterian College team, this was serious business.
And there was no clowning around, and Sam demanded that they be good sports at all times and not ever get into fights or, you know, mocking a team that they might. They had to be good winners and good losers. So as Sam would always say, no team is better than its poorest substitute. So for him, he demanded perseverance, sacrifice, and teamwork. Constantly. and it made the young women on the team kind of resent him after a while, but they did win.
Now, you mentioned, they won 89 consecutive games. Were any of the women really aware of that streak? Was it big news, or was it just sort of like, did newspapers treat it like, well, this is women's sports and it doesn't really matter? When you think of all the attention given to Connecticut these days.
Right. Well, the town of Durant supported them wholeheartedly. They went to their games and helped finance the team. And I think part of the reason they were so successful was because of the support from the town. And as they started winning, they became more popular in the, you know, in the Tulsa and Oklahoma City newspapers, but it really wasn't until they won the national championship and Dahl was named the best player the best women's basketball player in America, that really and truly their popularity took off. And newspapers did cover women's sports back then. Sometimes it was kind of as a sideshow carnival, but other times the writers were very, very interested in the skills of the women athletes.
Now, you tell the story through that first year, that first national championship,
mm-hmm.
And you talk about barnstorming. You know, they went down to Houston, they went up through Louisiana, and then ended up in Arkansas, and then came back home.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like as this streak grew, they were playing far larger schedule.
Yeah.
You mentioned they went all the way up to Canada.
That was the next year after they won the 1933 national championship. They were invited by the Edmonton grads, who were the world champion women's basketball team, who happened to play full court basketball, to play best 3 out of 5 games.
Hmm.
And
they played full. They played full court.
They had to learn full. They had 6 weeks to learn to play together under the men's rules. And they brought in the coach from Southeastern Teachers College down in Durant, and then they played against the men's college team to become experts at full court basketball, and they beat the Canadian grads in their own game.
Wow!
So they were almost magical as a team together. It was just that was the fun part to read about them. And yet Lucille Thurman's, at least the first year that she was playing, her notes said that she expected to lose every game. She never expected to win a game. So it was, for them, that first year, completely unexpected.
The name of the book is Dust Bowl Girls. Lydia Reeder, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Lydia Reeder is the author of Dust Bowl Girls, the inspiring story of a team that barnstormed its way to basketball glory. It's published by Algonquin Books. She'll be appearing in an event hosted by Magic City Books tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Edison High School. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.